listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
Well, it's been a couple of months, Edward. We had a bit of a bumper episode last month on dark energy and black holes. So we've got a couple of months worth of news to catch up on. Let's start off with launches, space launches. The big one that's been in the news, obviously, recently is the SpaceX Starship launch, which took place a couple of weeks ago as we record this, or last week as we record this even. I mean, it was quite impressive to look. Well, it was very impressive to look. The potential to be the most powerful rocket ever launched, right? It's 33 engines, I think.
And it was a very large number of engines. And it's quite significantly different to the type of rocket launches that we're used to with NASA and ESA launches, where in those you have the solid boosters that basically get you off the ground, and then you have the chemical boost, the chemical rocket, which then takes you know the rest of the way. And Starship just has chemical; it doesn't have any solid.
So it's more
rockets.
Like the Saturn V of the Apollo era than what you might think was more modern rockets, right? Which was just a load of chemicals, hydrogen and oxygen shoved together, burn, yep. Bang.
Yeah, that's right. And the advantage, I mean, there are advantages and disadvantages. The reason that people favour, the Europeans and NASA now seem to favour having solid rocket boosters is because they're really safe. Mm. You don't have explosions on the launch pad as frequently with those because, they can't go off. You can't have burning, in the wrong place. But they are like a firework. Once you've lit them, you have no control. So, just goes. You have a lot more control if you have chemical fuel instead of just solid fuel. It was quite beautiful to see these Raptor engines, as they're called in SpaceX. These little, instead of having, a small number of very large engines like we're used to seeing with the Saturn V rockets, there's over 30 of these Raptor engines. And when they were doing their calibration, you could see that they each of them have a little bit of movement. They can move very slightly, sort of shimmy from side to side. And by turning them on and off and having this shimmy, you can actually move the rocket's trajectory. And that's how you make it steerable, which is actually quite a clever piece of engineering to do that when you've got such an intense burn happening at the bottom. And so I watched the launch and it paused for only a few minutes at T-minus 40 seconds, which was nail-biting a little bit. And then instead of it just being completely stopped, it then carried on. And just as it carried on, somebody came to my front door. Which was really annoying. So my parents came to the front door, and so I said, "Can't talk to you. Come in and watch the rockets."
were they impressed by the rocket launch?
My dad was. My dad was very impressed with it. My dad was even more impressed when it had the unscheduled disassembly.
Yes.
So the as they call or explosion, as everybody else called.
Yes.
Calls it.
So this was about 4 minutes into the flight, I think. So it's after those 33 engines, of which I think half a dozen or so weren't working deliberately or unintentionally or intentionally. It's not clear at this stage. But it lifted off. It fired for 4 minutes, got it going very fast and very high, which is the goal of that first stage. But then the bit it didn't do was let go and separate from the rest of the rocket. And that meant that the thing started to spin, and either it automatically or someone down in range control, instead of letting it then crash somewhere, just blew it up. So you don't end up with a rocket falling on someone, which is even in the ocean, that would not be a good idea, because by that point, it's a long way down range. This was just a test launch. So it was just to launch the Starship, this impressive thing on the top, which is designed to be able to take over 100 tons into low Earth orbit and then maybe take people to the Moon and Mars and so on. So an impressive piece of equipment on the top of that, which was going to belly flop in the ocean. I don't think they were going to actually recover it in the end, is my understanding. But the plan is that in the long term, these things are reusable, like a lot of the SpaceX rockets, the idea is it brings down the cost. There were lots of queries about the regulation of this kind of stuff. So obviously NASA, ESA, the European Space Agency, are all regulated in what they can do. And there were concerns about private companies doing some of this stuff. And there was a concern with this, not from the actual rocket itself, but from the launch pad, because when you light 33 very powerful engines and fire them at a concrete block, the concrete block breaks. And in this case, bits of it exploded and went 6.5 miles away. Pulverized concrete travels 6.5 miles away into nature reserves and so on. So there's some question marks over how safe and how environmentally safe that is, I guess, which is a concern with private industry doing some of this stuff, I guess.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it seems really cavalier not to have considered more viable options than just having a concrete pad. Because when you think about the NASA launches, you see these big plumes coming out from underneath the rocket. And that's because they have a huge tank of water underneath the rocket that just gets vaporized. And that's what that is, those huge, these huge plumes.
So it vaporizes the water instead of vaporizing the launch pad itself.
Yeah, and the water, you know, is safe. It cools down very, very quickly. And then you've just got water, you know, it might rain a bit. When you think about the Russian rocket launches, they did have, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they still continue to have a platform instead of having any sort of water tank. But they have a cooled platform, I think. They also assembled their rockets horizontally, whereas NASA always assembled them vertically, and Roscosmos like tips them up through 90 degrees, which is always strikes me as quite a dangerous thing, but that's where they've always done it.
It's always surprising they're structurally stable enough to be able to do that. You sort of imagine when they're at 45 degrees, they'll snap in the middle or something. But
yeah, exactly.
I guess they've solved that problem because they've been doing it for 60 odd years.
So there are ways of doing it that don't require a huge water tank, but hopefully SpaceX will learn from this.
Well, they're saying they've got plan. I think the statement, I'm very much paraphrasing, but the statement from Elon Musk, who of course heads the whole operation, was along the lines of, oh yes, we're looking at a water-cooled plate to put underneath, but we haven't got around to it yet. I very much paraphrase that. But I think that smacks of a little bit about the cavalier attitude to, oh, you know, we broke a launch pad, you know, so what? Well, it showered concrete 6.5 miles away is the so what, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's
and it's also a little bit of a vanity project, this.
Yeah.
It's a huge amount of money. It has a huge environmental impact. It's not really driving new technology. These Raptor engines are new, but they're built on the fact, you know, on other things that have come before them. So it's not wholly a new project.
It's taking the relaunchable vehicles to a different scale, I guess, because the Falcon 9, even the Falcon 9 Heavy, which has three Falcon 9 rockets, the SpaceX's big rockets, side by side, this is saying, can we do this with one of these absolutely enormous rockets and land that safely? So that's a new scale. But yeah, you're right. The technology itself is relatively old. It's essentially a matter of, you know, engineering this so it works at this scale. So we wait to see whether they do more test launches. I know there were more test launches planned, and whether they can get this working. But these big rockets, they are having a few issues with getting them working reliably, it seems. It seems there are more issues with this than the other rockets, but maybe there's just more press interest. I'm not sure. Slightly further afield, we had, on a much smaller scale, I guess, we had a Japanese private industry, private company called iSpace that tried to send a lander to the moon. This was a lander. It was due to, I think it had been a few months orbiting on its journey to the moon. And it was due to land. It's Hakuto R Mission 1, or M1 to its friends. Unexpectedly accelerated, which is a bad idea when you're trying to slow down and land on the moon. And so it looks like it went into freefall. So it probably thought it had landed, or something. Its sensors told it had reached the surface, so it turned off its engines, and it hadn't landed. To get to 90 meters from the lunar surface for a private company is really very impressive. And you know, hopefully they can do this again, and hopefully got some data out of what they tried. But I guess, everyone, it's always said that space is hard. This, I guess, goes to prove it, that landing on the moon is is hard.
It's really quite amazing that now we're in this era of private companies being able to do this. It just shows how much wealth there is in the world, that people, that it's not nations that can afford to do this, but private companies. In some ways, it's quite disgusting, actually, that private companies have this amount of money that they can waste on failed missions, which I don't know what their iSpace's aims are, but if they're a private company, there's either somebody extremely wealthy who has this as a hobby, or they're hoping to capitalize on sending equipment and people to the moon.
Well, I think that's it. I think they're planning a rover for next year, and then later, further afield, they're planning to work with the US companies to help supply a way of helping NASA and other agencies, I'm sure, get stuff to the moon, get payloads to the moon, and then maybe even people by 2040, I think, is their plan. So, decade and a half away. But yeah, they have bigger plans in terms of getting to the moon. But you're right. I mean, it's private companies doing this. There are some alarm bells that ring with a lot of people about what that means in terms of regulation and what that means, yeah, longer term for the sustainability of this. In terms of private companies and regulation, we had at the start of the year the launch failure of Virgin Galactic, Cosmic One, from UK soil, the little rocket that launched from underneath a Boeing 747, I think, or jumbo jet at least. That company has now essentially filed for bankruptcy. So that company has folding, or is in the process of folding. Having said, we have concerns about the cavalier attitude of companies. It is a shame to see people trying to, you know, develop new technology failing. That's always a shame, because there are lots of ways of getting to space, and this is potentially one of the more sustainable ones.
Yeah, that's right. I really like the idea of strapping a space-worthy vehicle onto the back of a very large aeroplane. It's considerably less environmentally damaging. You know, both parts are reusable, or at least reusable and recoverable. Mm. And it's such a shame that, you know, there are things like SpaceX, which seem to have, like you say, a very cavalier attitude towards environmental issues, whereas Virgin Galactic seem to have had a much more reasonable attitude towards it, and much more sustainable attitude.
Mm. In non-private companies, there's been a success. So, several successes, I'm sure, but the one to highlight, I guess, is the launch of JUICE, which is the Jupiter Icy Moon Explorer. So that launched mid-April on its way to Jupiter. This is a very, very large satellite. So it's going to orbit Ganymede and study Europa, two of Jupiter's moons. Look for all sorts of things like the signs of liquid water under the ice, and study their environments in more detail. But don't hold your breath. You've got to wait about 8 years before it gets there. This is a slow burn to get to the result, right?
Yeah, it's got a lifetime of about 4 years once it's there and doing its stuff. But yeah, like the majority of missions that head towards the outer solar system, it does take quite a while for it to get there. It's considerably further than the moon.
Closer to home than Jupiter, let's go in towards the inner solar system. And I guess the question here is, when is a comet not a comet? When it's an asteroid. So this is Phaethon, which is an asteroid, previously thought to be a comet just because it generates meteors. So a meteor shower called the Geminids, which take place, the Earth passes through that debris stream left behind by the object in mid-December. So it's quite dark early on in the Northern Hemisphere there. So it's quite a popular one to go and see in the Northern Hemisphere, the Geminids. The Phaethon is unusual because it definitely looked to be an asteroid, not a comet. So people have called it rocky comet or rock comet and so on before. And thought to be maybe venting material and have this tail. But new instruments using actually solar satellites, so SOHO, which is designed to observe the sun, has been up there getting on 30 years now, I think, observing the sun, has instruments that can look at specific wavelengths, to look at specific materials. And it didn't see a dust tail as Phaethon passed by the sun, but it did see a sodium tail, so sodium particles. And that's odd, because meteors are not made of sodium.
Yeah, that's right. It was as well as Soho, there was the Stereo mission that also confirmed this. As well as I think another one, maybe the Parker Solar Probe, also had a look at this. Yeah, it's extremely interesting, not only because it's unexpected that the material coming off it is not large, you know, it's molecules, it's sodium, rather than being particles. But also because it has something so unexpected on its surface. This also means that where did the supply for the Geminid meteor shower come from? And it seems likely that there was some big collision or some event that maybe there was, you know, an eruption on the surface that showered some of the rock from the surface. And that's what laid the path that the Earth plows through that produces the Geminid meteors. But yeah, sodium, that's one to carry on watching.
But it does mean, Soho and Stereo and Parker Solar Probe have found lots of sun-grazing comets, these objects that seem to pass very close to the sun. It's been assumed that they're comets coming in from the outer solar system, but actually maybe some of those are, in fact, like Phaethon. They're asteroids which are venting material, albeit molecular material, so, you know, molecules of, say, sodium or nitrogen or something from their surface, rather than little tiny grains that are going to form a meteor shower. So, it has implications for other objects.
If there's these, so, you know, solar grazing comet stroke asteroids, they will have originated most likely from the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, rather than from the outer solar system, and so their composition will be quite different. So it's in a sense it's not really a surprise that the tail is not what we expected if they are asteroids, because, you know, they're not comets, they're not coming from the outer solar system. But still, having such an unexpected result is actually a really nice thing in science.
Yeah, it's worth saying, we should say what on a comet a tail actually is, of course. A tail on a comet is the icy material which is getting heated up by the sunlight when they get close, and then turning straight from solid ice into often vapor is erupting from the surface or being released from the surface, and you get little grains of material coming with it as well. So comets are actually pretty dusty and dirty. They're not just ice balls or snowballs, but it's the impact of the sun's heat that lets that stuff escape from the surface, sort of vent into space, which you don't expect from a solid rock like an asteroid. Okay, staying in the solar system, old 30-year-old data from Venus. So Venus, this is the planet, of course, is Earth's evil twin, with its very thick atmosphere and inhospitable surface, with crushingly high pressures and scorching temperatures. It's long been assumed, it's had a lot of volcanism on its surface, but there's been a long-standing question about whether there's active volcanism actually taking place now, you know, these days, or whether it's all millions or hundreds of millions of years old. And with a bunch of new missions set to go to Venus, I think there's three set to launch in the next few years, people have been going back and looking at data from previous missions, the most sophisticated of which, we had Venus Express a few years ago. Before that, we had Magellan in the 1990s. And it didn't take pretty pictures in the sense of a camera that we're used to. It took radar maps, so it mapped the surface. And someone's gone and studied one of the mountains on Venus to look at what that was doing. Mart Mons, the highest mountain on Venus, I believe, to see what that was doing when Magellan was looking at it. And it found a surprise.
One of the reasons that this data was looked at was because of this mission Veritas being selected. And an astronomer thought, well, since this mission's being selected, this Veritas mission, I should really find out what's been done before. And that's why there was this unexpected result in 30-year-old data. And the amazing thing was that this data was, you know, public and could be searched through. And within less than a year, within a few months, there was a difference in two radar maps of the same region. And it looks like a volcano on Venus had changed shape. So there was a new lava flow on it, which is, you know, we tend to think of the Earth as being the only planet in our solar system that has some activity on it. But actually it's not. There's activity happening everywhere. This is actually a really nice thing to show that 30 years ago there were some, in some way, active volcanoes on Venus, and actually revisiting that with a new mission, with this Veritas mission, which is a long time in the future, will be a really interesting scientifically.
And volcanoes on Venus are odd because we've always thought of this being this inhospitable world, and so you imagine the photos that people had decades ago, or the imaginations people had of the surface were volcanoes erupting like crazy, but we've really struggled to get evidence for there being active volcanoes on the surface, partly because the atmosphere is so thick, you can't see through it directly. You get some infrared images that can maybe look at spots of the ground. There's been some evidence that some spots have got very hot. And so that implies that there's lava there, of course. And then now there's this, where the surface has changed, that says at some point the surface has changed shape. And the only way that you can really do that is with a lava flow. But it kind of feels like a lot of this is circumstantial rather than being, I mean, I guess this is some pretty good evidence that was a lava flow, but we've not seen a volcano in the process of erupting on Venus, which I guess is maybe that's the next holy grail of looking at Venus, is to find a volcano actually erupting.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you say, it's extremely difficult. The atmosphere is very thick, it's very dense, so it's very hard to actually get direct measurements of it, and probes that have been sent through the surface have just been essentially crushed by the heavy atmosphere.
Let's move from our solar system to a few billion light years away to galaxies that are some of the brightest things we see in the sky in terms of galaxies. So we don't see them with the naked eye, but our telescopes find these objects called quasars. They've been seen since the 1960s. A portmanteau of quasi-stellar objects. So these very, very bright point-like things that look like a star to the telescopes, but then clearly a long, long, long way away. Are these very, very active galaxies, active in a sense that they're emitting loads of light. And there's lots of something going on, was known back in the 60s and the 70s when they were first seen. And it's now known that these are emissions from around the black hole in the centre of the galaxy. So this is something going on right in the heart of these galaxies, and these supermassive black holes that are millions or billions of times the mass of our sun. But there's been a bit of a question about, well, these quasars seem to turn on and off in that sometimes they are emitting lots of light. And when I say sometimes, I mean for millions of years or billions of years, for long periods, we don't see them turning off on a human timescale. But there's evidence that they've come turned on and off, and what causes them to turn on and off. There's a huge amount of energy comes out of these things, and knowing how you trigger that kind of energy release has been a bit of a mystery for a while, and someone thinks they've figured it out.
These things are extremely far away, and for them to look like stars is quite, well, it's mind-boggling, the amount of energy that is coming out of them. It would basically, the amount of energy would, if it happened close to our, not only our solar system, but our galaxy, would be catastrophic. It's really, really quite an event that you do not want to be anywhere near. And like you say, it's been a puzzle of why they turn on. And a recent piece of research seems to have an indication of how this happens. So these galaxies that host quasars have the sort of thing that you expect of galaxies. They have stars, they have gas, and they have dust. And the gas seems to be on where normally you expect to see the gas, is on the outer part of the galaxy. But this study showed that if there's a collision with an external galaxy, that forces the gas, which is normally at the outer edge of a galaxy, it forces it in to the middle and feeds the monster at the center. And just prior to being consumed by this supermassive black hole, it does a massive burp. And that burp is what we see as this quasar activity, this huge, it's not, I was going to say a flash of light, but it's a flash that lasts millions of years.
Yeah, long flash,
an extended period of brightness. as it gobbles away at this gas.
The other thing that's come out this week about distant galaxies is something from a story or an image released, one of the first images released by the JWST. So this new infrared space telescope that was launched Christmas Day 2021, last July, put out its first images. And there was one particular image that got people a bit excited because it saw back, it saw galaxies billions and billions of light years away. So galaxies that existed very short, hundreds of millions of years after the Big Bang. So about 13.8 billion years ago, or just under that. And people have been studying those galaxies and were surprised to discover that there were some that shouldn't be there.
Yeah, little little red galaxies, little dots, basically, that appeared. This story actually reminded me of something that the Herschel Observatory saw, which was Herschel was another infrared telescope, but was looking at colder things, so cold dust, well, sort of warmish and cold dust. But things colder than JWST is looking at. And it also saw, when you looked just at out into space, saw what looked like noise, looked like dots all over the image. And actually, when you looked at it, it wasn't. They were resolved in some way. They were more than single pixels. They were very, very distant, dusty galaxies. And this reminded me of this. But with JWST, obviously, these are things that were hotter. They're shining light in a different part of the EM spectrum. Astronomers did some calculations on what these things could be, and they appeared to be galaxies that looked like fully fledged galaxies, but they were from fairly soon after the Big Bang, sort of on the order of a billion years after the Big Bang. And it appeared to have lots and lots of stars, like our Milky Way galaxy has, which is a bit crazy because, it takes, in some cases, millions of years to form stars, but in some cases, to have evolved stars, it takes billions of years. So how can you have, a full range of stars so early on in the universe, which is frankly mysterious and sounds impossible, until you think of the link with the previous story with quasars. How can you have something that looks like a bright dot, billions of light years away? Well, maybe it's a galaxy, and it's still likely to be a galaxy, but not with evolved stars, but with gas that's falling into a central supermassive, or maybe not supermassive, but mini supermassive black hole, proto supermassive black hole. I don't quite know what the term is, but slightly smaller than the ones that we see now. And these are baby quasars that we can see, which would actually be a really nice link with what we now understand quasars and galaxies to be.
And because galaxy mergers were much more common right in the start of the universe, because everything was close together, the universe was a bit more dense in terms of the distance between galaxies, there in principle would have been more of these mergers triggering more of these mini quasars. It's worth saying they had six of these what were termed impossible galaxies, and they've studied one of them in more detail and found it to be a mini quasar, so the jury's still out on the other five. But that certainly sounds, to me at least, a more likely explanation than forming a whole, as you say, a whole galaxy's worth of stars in an impossibly short period of time. So gut instinct is that's probably what they are, but you do actually have to go and check to check the other ones that have been found are this as well. So it's going to take maybe another year or so to get data, to get time to investigate these things. But
and it's early days for JWST too.
Yeah,
and there may be more of these things in other parts of the sky, and when we find more of them, we'll be able to analyze them in different ways depending on their circumstances, and learn more about this whole phenomenon.
And we shouldn't be blasé as well, I suppose, saying it's just a quasar. Well, it is a quasar from 700 million years after the Big Bang. Those are things that we haven't seen before, so these are still new objects and new ways of studying how quasars form. So it's still very exciting if that is the case, maybe less sort of revolutionary than we form galaxies in less than a billion years, but still exciting nonetheless. That's all we have time for this month. Don't forget, you can find past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk, where we're now hosted on anchor.fm. You can also find us on Spotify, of course. Just search for Pythagorean Astronomy. Until next month, goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.